Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Hey, Lars, thank you so much for sitting down with me. As I was just telling you kind of before we started, this is a big one for me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. I'm glad that we're finally able to do something like this because we're both super nerds. And when two super nerds get into the same room, a lot of nerdom can happen.
Absolutely. Well, you are speaking my language already. And as I know from our hangout a couple weeks ago, I got to steer it from going completely down a wrestling path because, my gosh, I could punish you on that topic forever as well. So, but I guess I want to start them off the way I start them all off. Sorry, start this off the way I start them all off, which is, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you kind of ever came across it?
Yeah, you know, I was probably, you know, because I think, you know, it all goes back to like my first introduction to music. It was all from my older brother, Robert. Mm-hmm. So he brought everything home. So when I was 4 years old, I heard Kiss. You know what I mean? Basically, like, then it was like Kiss. Then it was like AC/DC. Then it was like Cheap Trick. Then it was the Cars. Then it was like punk and oi. So I want to say probably 79 80. My brother was a skinhead, so he brought home a lot of the reggae music. There was a kid named Sean Gregonis who moved into town. He was from like San Luis Obispo, and him and his dad moved up. They moved onto our street, and he was kind of like the first punk rocker we had ever seen. And he had, you know, shaved head, white t-shirt, combat boots, rolled up jeans. Walked around with a boombox playing like, I think it was like X or some shit, a Black Flag. And he was like the first punk rocker I think we ever saw in real life. And then, you know, with that, you know, brought this whole sort of subculture to Sherman Palms, Campbell, California. And my brother, of course, you know, being, you know, we were sort of the outcasts anyway. So we kind of he gravitated towards Sean. Him and Sean became friends. And then, of course, as all great younger brothers want to be more like their older brothers, that I kind of, you know, and I was always into music. So I remember hearing like GBH for the first time, or, you know, the Cockney Rejects. It was mostly the English stuff, you know, the first American band I ever really truly fell in love with was Social Distortion, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that was like one of my first shows was Social Distortion, you know, and I got to meet the guys, and you know, it was such a cool thing. Cause you were, you know, you were kind of same as, you were the same as everybody else in the scene. There wasn't any rock stars, you know, there wasn't any, breathing fire and explosions, you know what I mean? Which maybe it could have used, who knows, but, yeah, but my point is that it was just like, we were working class kids. We're actually working poor before the term was even fucking made, you know? So we grew up in project housing, and I think the music, the attitude, it was really easy to gravitate to. Cause even the kids, even this music that was coming from England, we could identify with because it sounded like they were coming from the same neighborhoods, you know?
Absolutely. About breathing fire on stage. Every time I've seen a punk band try and do that, it's ended in a disaster. I'm going to say a good 60% of the times I've seen a band try it. So maybe it's better to go back.
Well, I'm actually happy to say that I've never, ever seen a punk band try that. But
the infamous Toronto They Live tragedy show, that was a legitimate tragedy for one of the singers of They Live, unfortunately, that night.
Got you. Which is a great movie featuring our friend Roddy Piper.
Absolutely. And that was totally where they got it from. I think they opened the 7-inch with a sample, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
Back when you could get away with that such thing.
Yeah. Before, yeah. Before that was all pre-internet shit. That's when literally jack a movie sample, put it on your record, and no one would have found out for 20 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I kind of remember like the Swarm doing it on a 10-inch, and they had like the whole thing was like lifted Taxi Driver snippets. And that was the first time I remember a pressing plant being like, nah, you can't do this.
Well, you know, it's a funny story. Like before, you know, and which never made the record, but I still have the master with the soundbite. There was a Spider-Man TV show, and we had Sick of It All singing backgrounds on avenues and alleyways. And Spider-Man basically in this TV show says, not to steal anybody's line, but it's clobbering time, you know, from the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we sampled that for the beginning of, for the intro of Avenues and Alleyways. And it was off that Spider-Man TV show at the time. And we recorded it, whatever, and from a VHS tape, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think BJ Pappas, who was this photographer in New York, she would do like a you know, every time Rancid rolled through, she took photographs, Sick of It All, Agnostic Front. She took photos of everybody.
She's on the H2O record, I think, right? No, correct. Is that her? Yeah,
pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's the H2O record. I'm trying to think.
Well,
she definitely took photos of them.
Yeah, I've definitely seen her photography before. I will check this and put this in the beginning of the show.
Right, but I think she was the one that got us the sample. So, and it was kind of like an homage to Sick of It All because, you know, at the time we were thick as thieves and, you know, and, but it got dry. It never made it to the mastering. But
yeah. I mean,
who knows what a legal trouble we would have had with Marvel Comics, you know, if we did go ahead and do that. You know what I mean?
Well, now it would be with the Disney Corporation too. So it'd be even,
exactly.
even worse. So maybe it worked out for the best.
Yes, exactly.
Cool sample.
But I mean, but that was the time though. You could do those things and get away with them. But I don't necessarily, with the success of that record, I don't know if we ever would have, you know, I mean, because that was out there, you know what I mean? So I don't necessarily know if we would have left unscathed on that one, but
no,
no, probably not.
No, not at all. I always wondered why CM Punk never came out to Clobbering Time. Like, obviously he did the intro.
Right.
But I always thought it'd be such a cool entrance for a wrestler.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I wondered why CM Punk never used a fucking Rancid song for a goddamn intro, you know,
and that's very true.
A bone of contention. I go, dude, you got a fucking guy here. Like, what is fucking wrong with you? You know what I mean? And I remember like they were shooting his documentary and they wanted to cut, they came and cause he came to the show with us in Albany, New York. And a lot of that backstage stuff with him, with us, was in Albany.
Yeah.
And I think I put him on the spot that night before we did Last One to Die. I was like, if I was a professional wrestler, this is what I would want my theme song to be. And I just kind of looked right at him and he was just kind of looking at me like, fuck you, dick. Like, why are you putting me on the spot? You know what I mean? It's like, come on, bro, brother. I mean, here I am, like this super wrestling fan. And I've never seen any one of my fucking, any song I've ever been a part, well, besides, there's been a few, you know, to come out to it.
The Backyard Wrestling video game. You guys are on that soundtrack.
Yeah, but I mean, and there's a lot of great wrestlers, you know, that have come out to Bastard songs and, you know what I mean? And really cool stuff. And I am honored. But it's like when it's your buddy, when it's one of your best friends and he's coming out to fucking, you know, some, I mean, I'm not taking in anything away from Living Color.
No.
That is it's a great track. I mean, let's just be honest. And, you know, but, and actually, honestly, the lyrical content actually fit his persona at the time. So it totally makes sense. But, you know, whatever. It was kind of like, throw your fucking friend a bone here, dick. You know what I mean? Like,
well, I heard it through the grapevine. He might have another fight coming up that maybe he needs walkout music for. So, you know.
Well, you never know what can happen.
You never know what can happen. But, yeah, no.
I'm waiting for the phone call, punker.
I agree, though. I definitely agree, too. You want your WrestleMania moment. You know,
you know what? I need my WrestleMania. Look, I've experienced a lot in my life. Okay. Granted, I've been, you know, fortunate enough to have some success in my life, but you know what? I've never had my WrestleMania moment. And that's the one thing I'll go to my grave going, I need my WrestleMania moment.
Yeah, but, no, absolutely. I think that is
joking aside.
No, absolutely. I agree. I think that's totally, totally fair. And I think also, Like that's as a wrestling fan, that's like the one big thrill that you could like we have fucked up licensed Daniel Bryan or Bryan Danielson at the time, generation for the first two ROH TV tapings, and that to me is probably the biggest achievement of my life.
It's amazing. It's amazing when you like look at your life and your success, like what you feel a success. And I'm the same way, dude. It's like, how much have I been involved, or my music, or something I've done that has been involved in wrestling? That's how I measure my success.
Well, I was going to say, how does it feel to have been in the best WWE DVD ever? Like,
Well, you
legitimately.
know, and I thought that was a good one. I really honestly did. And I know, that it's easy for me to say because, obviously, the guy's my brother, and I might be biased, but legitimately, like, that was like the most honest one I've ever seen them put out.
Yeah, and I think it set the tone for the ones to kind of come after to be better.
Exactly. So, no, exactly. And, and that's the thing. It's a shame that he's no longer doing it. Like, I miss him in that, because he's such a great performer. He was one of the last wrestlers that truly have psychology and brought that to the ring. I remember just that whole series that he did with Regal, and but to for the IC Championship, and just remembering the two of them, having the psychological. It was there's the 4-year-old.
Don't worry, mine will make a run in soon, I imagine.
But it's like the psychology. Soren, I love you very much. All right. Okay, so let me try to find another room.
I understand.
But the psychology that they brought to the ring was like something that hadn't really been seen in a long, long time. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like he was, and he is like one of the all-time greats. And I think we all still have that, Tanahashi fantasy, Tokyo Dome thing to look forward to, maybe. So I'm just saying, just putting it out there. But anyway, this is exactly what I thought was going to happen. So let's get back to your life story in Punk, because oh my gosh, I could talk wrestling with you all day. Oh, but back to, so what was kind of your first, like you mentioned, Social Distortion was the first show that you really connected with. What was your first show you went to? Not, it didn't even have to be Punk, like concert even.
It was a punk show. And I remember because I distinctly remember going to see AC/DC for the first time in the big gigantic arena, and I was thinking, what they do? They do concerts in places like this? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't even really think, like, But yeah, I was probably see. There was a couple. There was a couple. There was a Black Flag show with DOA. And I remember I got my ass kicked by my own brother. So here's what happened. So it was at Briner Hall in Campbell, California, and I oh shit, I can't remember what even fucking year it was. But anyway, it was really I was really really young. And my brother had now clicked up with a bunch of people, and on the corner of Campbell Avenue in Hamilton, there was a gas station, and in behind that gas station, there was an alleyway with like a fence, and you could go back there. A lot of the kids would go back there and drink beer, and because the show was literally a hop, skip, and a jump from there, maybe a block away. So I remember I had gotten stoned. Somebody passed me a joint, whatever. I smoked it. I was probably about 10,
Wow.
11, and I got stoned, and I was really stoked. I was stoned, but it was dark outside, so it started kind of getting kind of creepy for me because you're 10, you're
You're 10.
stoned, and I remember my mom said basically I could go to the show because my brother was there and that I was his responsibility. So anyways, I'm walking by, I'm looking, I'm going, I'm walking around, because I'm high, and I distinctly remember the feeling of like being high and enjoying it, like, whoa, this is like I've arrived. Kind of feeling, I remember walking by this fence, and all of a sudden I heard this commotion, and next thing I'm on the floor and I'm getting kicked and I'm getting punched, and then all of a sudden I hear this voice go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, stop, 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 stop. That's my little brother. That's my little brother." So basically my brother and his buddies were waiting behind this fence to roll onto somebody, And I just happened to be the unlucky person who walked by at that time. And so he picks me up and kind of dusts me off a little bit. And he goes, "You okay, man? You okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, I'm fine." And he goes, what's wrong with you?" And I go, "I'm really stoned," you know, like I'm not proud as I made this statement. I'm really stoned. And he's like, "You're what?" I go, "I'm really stoned." And all of his friends start, you know, kind of laughing like, "Hey, welcome to the club," kind of thing. And then my brother starts just literally beating the shit out of me and saying, "You're my responsibility. Mom's going to kill, blah, 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 blah." You know, it starts and then makes me walk home the mile and a half back home by myself in the dark at like 10 o'clock at night.
Holy.
And I'm stoned and I'm scared now, you know, because it's just like it's a long walk when you're 10, number one. And when you're stoned, everything kind of moves even that much slower, mm-hmm. you know, so you add all the factors in there. That's what I remember of my first punk show.
And you have little kid legs, so it takes a lot longer to walk.
Amen to that.
Oh my!
Amen to that.
Wow, that's what a terrible first show.
I was gonna ask
you what you remember's DOA set, but I guess that doesn't really stand out that much.
Yeah, no, I can't even recall if I ever really even went into the show, honestly.
Yeah,
it was more of the scene. I mean, it was big. It was like a big, wide open world. I mean, you know, my world at that time was like Little League and you know. My record collection and pro wrestling, like it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that big, you know, you're 10, you're not supposed to have a big world anyway. You're supposed to, you know what I mean? But the way we grew up though, you know, there was a lot of shit that was going down, you know I mean?
Yeah.
There was people getting shot and, you know, there was a lot of violence and gangs and stuff like that. And so, I mean, we were kind of exposed to sort of more, I guess, with, for lack of a better term, more adult themed kind of things in the 70s, early 80s than the kids now who are growing up now would be, you know what I mean? Or maybe they are, but they just, you know, maybe it's a lot more real. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that my kids probably hopefully will never have to see that kind of lifestyle, you know?
Yeah. Like I'm not talking about even as extreme as what you're talking about, like where you have to worry about shootings and violence, but I'm just thinking about how, you know, we had a call with my kid. He was at a sleepover, my eldest, and they wanted to put on an R-rated movie, and it was just like, what? An R-rated movie? And like, I'm thinking back, but I'd seen all that stuff by the time I was 7. Like, I already had a Freddy Krueger poster on my wall when I was 8.
See, that's what I mean. It's like that. Our, you know, my mom smoked when she was pregnant with me. I mean, yeah. Come on. It's like, you know, it's just like they didn't, it was the 70s, man. Shit happened. Like yep. nobody shaved and everybody like did, it was over excess. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so. Well, I think it's just like, it's just now I think we quote unquote know better, you know, like yeah. about a lot of things. And it's like, I think about even myself, like, you know, I had a fairly sheltered-ish upbringing, but I was still downtown Toronto going to these shows by myself at 12 years old. 13 years right. old. And it's like, I was exposed to a lot of crazy stuff going to these shows down, being downtown, going to these concerts. And it's like, I don't know if I'm going to let my 13-year-old have the same liberties.
No, you know, I mean, I think about some of the things that I've done, you know, in my life and at, you know, at an early age. I mean, I think my oldest, he's like 8 years old. He's going to be 9 in September. And I think 2 years from now, you know, basically is when I got exposed to this music, to this culture, to the scene.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's when I shaved my head. I became a little skinhead. You know, I got my pair of boots. You know what I mean? I rolled up, bleached all my jeans. You know what I mean? I wore suspenders, although they were like 5 inches thick. You know, I did everything I possibly could. I mean, I didn't know about a Fred Perry or a Ben Sherman. We got those Britannia ones, you know, those polo shirts. But yeah, I mean, and you know, another thought I was thinking was the first time I saw Soulcer Distortion, and I followed Dennis Danelle around the club because he had a Soulcer Distortion button on his overcoat, and I wanted that button. And I remember I went up these stairs, and it was like this weird kind of hallway that you go up these stairs and you go down, and you're at the other part of this room. And he waited for me on the other side of the stairwell because he obviously figured out that I was following him, and he goes, "What do you want?" And I was like, "I just want your button." And he goes, "Oh, okay." And he actually gave me his button off of his jacket. You know what I mean? And it was really cool. And we ended up, the first time I ever got like had a salty dog, which is like vodka and grapefruit juice. I was in the back before the show with all the Social Distortion guys, and it was Derek and Brent and Mike and Dennis. And me and Dennis became friends. He like gave me his phone number, you know what I mean? And when they came through two times later, I mean, my mom made them frozen hamburgers and they crashed on my floor, you know, when they played the American Legion Hall in Campbell, you know what I mean? Like that's the way the scene was, you know, they came over to the house, my mom's cooking frozen hamburgers and she's okay with them being punk, but she doesn't want me and my brother to be punk. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you know, and it's like, you got Social Distortion in your house, eating hamburgers with them. And then you're next thing you know, you're in the van and you're going to the show, you know?
Well, like, it's funny. Cause when you, like, it's the impact that had on you as a kid. Cause like my brother, when Outcome the Wolves came, you guys did a thing at CFMY where you showed up just at CFMY to do an interview. And my brother and I were listening to the radio and heard like, oh my God, Rancid's at the radio station. We live like across town. And he was like 11 and I couldn't leave. I was grounded and had to finish a school assignment. So I'm like, I hand him this shirt that I have that I'm staring at right now with all these bands that I got to see like the first couple years I was going to shows. And I'm like, get this signed. And he grabbed the first CD he found, which was his Operation Ivy CD, and took off running and got on the subway. And I remember seeing him nearly get hit by a car as he took off outside of our house. And he made it there and met you guys and like got all the stuff signed. And I remember came back and he had you had signed his Operation Ivy CD. He's like, I felt so bad because I had only had this Operation Ivy CD, and he hands it to you and you're like, oh, no problem, man. I'm happy to sign this for you. I love this record. And it's just like you guys were at the, like, in the middle of this crazy shitstorm that I'm sure we're going to hopefully talk about today.
Yeah.
And you were still cool to this kid, you know, this like 11-year-old kid. So it's obvious that Social Distortion thing had an impact on you.
Well, yeah, but that's the whole thing. I mean, like the punk rock, why I gravitated to that more than to Motley Crue is because pure and simply, the people that were making the music were just the same as you. You know what I mean? And if you're coming to the punk show, then you must feel as fucked up as I do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that to me was, like you said, I mean, there was an off, a connection that when I came up through this whole thing, it's like, you're all one and the same. You all look out for each other. It's you against the world. And these bands, you know, you felt like were yours, you know, that those were your bands telling people how you felt. And then you sing the lyrics with them. And then it was like you were in the band because they were talking about what you felt. You know, it wasn't like a far off concept. I didn't know anything about, you know, that's why my Kiss records ended up going onto the shelf. You know what I mean? Is it, you know, I didn't know what Christine 16 meant until I was like 15. Okay, he likes the young ladies. Okay, but you know what I mean? Like, I just thought it was a nice song about Christine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whatever. You know. So I mean, not that I was that naive, but naive enough. You know, naive enough
to that world at least. Yeah.
Exactly. So but that wasn't something that seemed reachable in my world. You know, I never thought about, you know, like becoming rich and famous, you know. I never like, I wanted to be, of course, because I came from, you know, a shitty fucking low income housing apartment building, you know what I mean? Where there was lots of craziness and lots of fucking violence and just, you know, gnarliness. And for me, like, if that was a way out of this fucking thing that I was living, then I would have gladly taken it, you know? And that's kind of where my head was. But I never like had, you know, these grand visions of me becoming successful at making music. It just sort of happened, you know what I mean? And that's the thing. We were just, you know, as far as Rancid was concerned, we were just like four working class kids who just, you know, toured a lot and wrote, you know, some good songs that people somewhat, you know, identified with, you know?
Well, we're going to, my God, if we get into even your B-sides, I was just listening to like a bunch of B-sides today and we'll get into that. My God, there's lots of places to go here, Lars. So many places to go. But back to where we were. You brought up your record collection that you had, you know, around that time. You brought the Kiss records. What other stuff were you getting? Was it just stuff that your brother was kind of bringing up? And where were you kind of buying records at that point?
Well, Tower Records was great. There was the Tower Records on Bascom Avenue. And they had an import section. So you could go there and you could get like, you know, I found Blitz All Out Attack.
Whoa.
You know, I mean, I found Exploited Computers Don't Blunder. I found, I remember I bought the first Meteors record, or not the first record, but Wrecking Crew. And I didn't, it was at the time when you looked at the cover and the cover was cool, you'd buy it, you know?
Yeah.
And they put them in these plastic sleeves, right? So you could change the price tag, you know what I mean? By just undoing the plastic sleeve and putting the record into a different plastic sleeve, because it was just held together with a piece of tape. So all you had to do is just be a little bit sneaky about it, change the record, and boom, there you go. I mean, it's before barcodes, you know? And
then all of a sudden you're getting a Blitz All Attack for the price of a Pat Benatar single.
Exactly. So so the 7 inches were in one room, and then you had the 12-inch vinyl on the other side, and it was the total import section. And you could find everything. I mean, I bought I remember when I got out of juvenile hall for the first time, I got busted for breaking and entering, Cruelty to Animals, Possession of PCP, Mayhem, and a few other of these things. And I was 11 years old, and
whoa.
I won't go into gory details, but basically I had this pack of chewing gum. Me and my friend, Mike Newman, who's now dead, he died a few years after this, but we broke into this house, and it happened to be like his girlfriend's house. We took the bus out there. We drank all the beer, and they had this little dog, and we started smoking some PCP, and this dog kept barking at me and barking at me. When you're high on PCP, you don't really want a dog to bark at you. And I remember I had this Tidal Wave chewing gum. It just had come out, and I had the green apple flavor. It had a liquid center. It was like all the rage, right? I remember I took the whole pack, I put it in my mouth, and I wrapped chewing gum around the dog. And the dog was trying to pick it off of its fur for the rest, so it stopped barking at me. Like, that was the best idea I could come up with at the time, you know, to get the dog. So I got busted for cruelty to animals because this dog obviously had chewing gum all of its fur, but it happened to be like this show winning dog too. Like, they had put this dog in, like, you know, dog shows and stuff and whatever. So they really threw the book at me.
Wow.
But yeah. And so then I ended up, like, you know, being high and stuff like that. And Mike started fucking with me, and I ended up, like, taking his eyeball out with what it's a long story, but we ended up getting busted. And, and I had taken $20 out of their parents' top dresser drawer. I remember I'd stashed the money. I knew the cops were going to come. I somehow got on the bus fucked up, and then the cops were at my house literally 3 or 4 hours later because Mike had ratted me out. I was in the back of a police car going to juvenile hall, but I had stashed the 20. So when I got out of juvie, I got my $20 and I walked down to Tower Records and I bought Strength Through Oi. And that's kind of the record that really set the tone for me for, like, the rest of my life, which was the second Oi record. I had the first Oi record, but the second Oi record is when I really was like, okay, this is it. This is kind of what I want to do. You know what I mean? So, and it was a compilation record, you know, and it was great because I loved comp records at the time, because you had the Last Resort, you had the Toy Dolls, you had the Strike, you had, you know, all these great bands all in one collection. And, you know, it was like perfect. You know, you didn't have to go buy single records, you know what I mean? And feel like you could get much more from it. You know what I mean?
Well, as a kid, especially, like, when you don't have access to a lot of funds, granted, I don't have a story like that about acquiring a record, but you know, like, that definitely, like, is compilations are the best way to find out about everything.
Exactly. And that's why I still love them, because,
yeah,
they honestly, like, a lot of my favorite records are the comps, you know, because, you know, all the Oi records were great, you know. There were some that were kind of lemons, you know, like the later ones, like the Oi of Sex and just stuff like that.
But, Son of Oi, I like. There's a couple tracks on Son of Oi that are okay.
Yeah. They had, yeah, I mean, there's some great songs on that. Wasn't there a song with that Prol band on there?
Yeah.
Yeah. But so, I mean, you know, I always liked those types of records mostly. But that also turned me on to buying bands' records. But then you had Blitz coming out with, like, Telecommunication and that other stupid fucking whack ass shit, you know, fucking, I was so bummed, dude, when I bought that fucking record that I still have to this day, and I've never thrown it away, because if I ever wanted to meet any of those fuckers, I was going to go, what the fuck is this about, bro?
You don't think that record now, I understand it hurt at the time, but isn't that, it's kind of cool in its own way? No?
Hells no, bro. Not in a fucking, if you're going to call your band fucking Blitz, you don't do a record like that. It's like if the Ramones came out with like some fucking like new romantic shit. You know what I mean? Like what the fuck? Like all of a sudden they have wave cuts. They look like Flock of Seagulls. No. The Ramones never did that. You know, the Ramones never let me down. Okay. What Blitz let me down.
Wow. Well, Mackie is a fan of the show, so maybe he will hear this now.
No, I love Mackie. I know Mackie, but Mackie wasn't part of that. That's true. He left. You know, Midge, God rest his soul, wasn't part of that either. So
yeah, that's true. He had gone by that point. But there were like, just prior to that, like some of those kind of like there's some, I don't know. I like some of the, not maybe not Telecommunication, but what's the single just before it?
Was it White Man like that?
Something like that. No, New Age. When they
but that's fine. That's fine. But I mean, come on, that's a great song.
That's a killer song.
You know, that was great. It wasn't, you know, I mean, that speaks for a whole generation, I think.
That's,
you know,
true. That's true.
So, and that's one of those songs that no matter what you, where you go, when you listen to it, it's still going to strike a chord with you. But it was after that, you know, I mean, yeah. Obviously, I mean, yeah. that record cover, obviously the New Age record cover was, you know, obviously a glimpse of things to fucking come, but little did we know that, like, you know, we're going to get fucking Telecommunication. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Like,
is that why you Rancid has never phoned it in on any of your comp tracks?
Bro, like, this is the way we feel about Rancid. Like, you know, we've always had this kind of ideology, like, you're going to spend money to come see us play, buy a record, you know, whatever it may be. We know what it's like to, we've all experienced in our lifetime, you know, buying a record that sucks. You know what I mean? Thinking you're going to get something and all of a sudden it's like, oh, great, your supply of tuna, you know, like on The Price is Right. Like I picked the wrong fucking door on this one. You know what I mean? So I feel like that we put our heart and soul into everything that we do. And that's what I try to do with every band that I've played with, is take that ideology and like bring it, you know, cause I don't want ever anybody to come up to me and say, yo, dude, I spent, you know, $12 or whatever on your record and it sucks. I mean, you know, there's always going to be people who will say that, just probably now more than ever, because they're going to hear this and go, well, I'm going to go up to Lars and say that I spent 12. But that's fine. Whatever. My point is, it's like, if I feel good, like if I, you know, if I make a record that I feel like I would buy, you know what I mean? And I'm not, it's not all about buying in dollars and cents. It's not all about that. I mean,
no, but it's about just sacrifice, right? Like people, you have a limited amount of resources. So what people are giving that to you. So I totally understand what you're saying. Like not a, it's no, not like a capitalist thing. It's just like a thing.
No. And it's just kind of the way that you have, you think about it at points. I mean, but I also go in and I don't, you know, think, is this, are people going to buy this? You know what I mean? Like, I'm just kind of like, I go in and I want to make songs that I want to hear. I want to see this, you know, and I think if you approach it like that, it's a safe bet, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, I was going to say, like, right from that Kill Rockstars compilation, like, on, it's like, some of my favorite songs that you guys have are these, like, random comp songs. Like, you guys stole, like, steal every comp. It's crazy. But anyway, we can go down that road later on. So after you kind of go to that Social Distortion show and before you, you know, the unfortunate incident with Juvenile Hall and stuff, were you going to shows in that mid gap, I guess, like pretty regularly or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it didn't matter to me if it was punk rock, I went to go see it. You know what I mean? It was, you know, the local bands like Ribsy, The Faction, you know, Any European band I'd go and see, you know, whether it's Discharge or GBH or Angelic Upstarts or whoever it was, you know, I mean, you put a name on it and I've probably seen it, you know. I was always that kid that collected the flyers too, you know. So I would take all the flyers from the shows I'd been to, put them up on my wall, and they were my mementos. They were, you know, before tattoos, right? So, you know, but a lot of great local bands, you know, that I would always go see and try to support just to be part of it, you know what I mean? And that was kind of what was most important to me, was being part of that part of the scene, because honestly, like, you know, at this point, you know, you had all those TV shows like Quincy and Chips, and then Donahue, the day my son, my, you know, after school special, the day my kid turned punk, and you know, you had all these things, and then these characters on these TV shows with name like Chemical Waste, you know, what's your name, Chemical Waste? It's like, my name is fucking Lars, dude. Like, you know what I mean? So you'd go to the mall with your friends if you had any. And, you know, like my best friend after, like, when the punk thing happened, and pretty much every single parent that I was, you know, of the friends that I did have said, you cannot hang out with that guy. I got banned from my own family. I couldn't go to Christmas or to Thanksgiving on because my dad's mom, my grandmother on my father's side and grandfather, they banned me from the house coming over, banned me and my brother. You know, blame my mom, my poor mom, Danish immigrant, sorry, you know, grew up during World War II, saw our family get killed, is losing control of her children. You know what I mean? Like, you know,
the last thing you need is to be cut off from support at that point.
Right, yeah. But my mom, you know, God bless her, she tried. You know, she was raising two boys by herself. By the time I was three, my dad was out of the picture. You know what I mean? And he would come in and out frequently, you know, but he was always sort of supportive of us being different, because he was different. He was a grease, you know? So, you know, like there was this whole in the family, there was a lot of fear, you know, there was a lot of craziness, you know what I mean? And growing up in a European sort of household, you know, where my mom's basically straight off the boat Danish and, you know, survived a war and stuff like that. You know, it wasn't like going over to, you know, John Smith's house, my buddy, you know, like, you know, where they were talking about something completely different at the dinner table than we were, you know? So you already felt like you belong to begin with, you know, it wasn't Leave It to Beaver style. It was, you know, we talked about things that, you know, if we did sit down at dinner with each other, but you know what I'm saying? It was a different, you know, I think we were more European, you know, in that sense of where we were brought up, like more with that kind of open-minded sort of mentality, you know, where we accepting, you know, was a little bit more, you know, wasn't so judgmental. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to say that, you know, America's, you know, Americans are, well, Americans are, it's kind of dumb sometimes, but you know what I'm saying? But like, including myself, but.
Well, Canadians are just as dumb. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we're just human beings trying to get on with our lives, but the point I'm trying to make is that from the get-go, I felt like an outsider. So when I found the punk rock thing, when I found the skinhead thing, when I found that subculture, like it was natural. It was as natural as like putting on your pants. You know what I mean? So, you know, it just, for me, that's where it was.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like, so I guess like, oh, I was going to ask you, was Sticky they're from San Jose area, right? Or no?
I think Sticky was from Hayward or some Hayward, shit like okay. that.
They're on like some. That,
another great band from fucking Social Unrest.
Social Unrest, yeah, unbelievable band.
I used to see them, and Crucifix was another one that we used to see all the time. And you know what I mean? And like, you know, like I said, the Dead Kennedys, and I remember seeing Camper Van Beethoven, you know, with the Dead Kennedys. You know what
with I mean? The Dead Kennedys?
Yeah, at the New Varsity in Palo Alto.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I remember seeing the audience reaction like to Camper Van Beethoven at a Dead Kennedy show at that point.
Well, you know, this was like 1986, maybe.
Oh, so it was later on, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, everybody was, you know, was pretty, I kind of remember being kind of chill, you know, I was Riot though when the DKs played there, everybody started up the shit, but I saw Suicidal, you know, all those bands, you know, like if there was a show you went, you know what I mean?
When Crucifix came through, did they come through with AF that time or?
I can't recall if they came.
When they did that, Punk Skins United tour. I only know because of all the flyers.
You know, I remember that. I could have been there. I don't know. There were so many shows, but Crucifix was a local band. They were Berkeley, San Francisco. So they would play in the Bay Area, it seemed like every weekend. And it's the same with the Dead Kennedys too. Like you felt like you saw the DKs every weekend. It was like, oh, what are you going to do? Oh, Dead Kennedys, let's go there. You know what I mean? Like that's what it felt like. I mean, the amount of times I saw the Dead Kennedys, there's probably only one other band that I've seen more than them, and that's probably GBH or Motorhead, you know, like I've seen GBH probably, safe to say, over 300 times. Like, but yeah, I mean, that was what it was like being in the Bay Area during that time. You know, there were so many great bands from so many different parts, you know. You had Blast from Santa Cruz. You had, you know, bands like, you know, Crucifix. And, you know, I mean, not all at the same time, but every part of the Bay Area contributed a band or 19. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it's like there was always something to do, you know?
Yeah, and when Mike was on the episode, he talked about like moving up to the Bay from L.A. and just how it was different because there wasn't as – like obviously there was violence, but there wasn't as much violence. So it was almost like you could go to a lot more shows and see a lot more stuff, it seems.
Yeah, well, we didn't have the problems that they did down there, you know? It was violent in like the early 80s. Like it got bad. You know, but a lot of times there'd be guys coming up from down south trying to like, you know, flex a little bit. And then you had the problems with like the fucking Boneheads. They were coming around a lot. And you know, a lot of people at points were scared to go to shows, you know, just because of, you know, that stupid shit. But a lot of those guys that turned out that way, I knew them when they all had skateboards, you know what I mean? And we like a joke within ourselves was like, oh yeah, oh, here comes a white power skinhead. You know, he was probably the little kid, skinny kid with the skateboard that everybody picked on. You know, I mean, now he's found a sense of power. Like, you know, it was just kind of, you know, stupid. But, you know, that sort of all kind of went away, got beat out of the scene. You know, I mean, a lot of people didn't stand for it. You know, a lot of people, you know, they don't come around no more, put it that way.
Well, there's that famous photo from the Floor Punch show where the Nazi skinhead's about to get smacked with a bat from behind and stuff. And it's like, so it's still something that I guess beats strong in that, you know, in that community, that scene, your scene, I guess.
Well, the thing about it is I don't call Nazi skinheads. They're boneheads. It's like skinhead comes from Jamaican reggae. If that's the origin, if that's the soundtrack, there's no way you can tout any kind of bullshit fucking neo-Nazism. It's a contradiction in terms. You know what I mean? Like you can have your politics and lean to the left or lean to the right. I mean, it's America. Do what you want. You know, but like those two and two don't go hand in hand.
Absolutely. So I guess like at this point, there's also that famous story that I wanted to ask you about you and MDC. I think it was in Details magazine in that feature way back when. I remember reading it, like getting, was it like them or was it the UK subs that smuggled you in a drug case?
Yeah, it was. Oh, oh fuck. You got to bring that up. All right. So I'm 19. I joined the UK subs, right? And we're going up to Scotland, and it's like my third show with the band. I've done two shows, you know, and they said, Lars, do you have a Scottish passport? And I say, a Scottish passport? And they say, yeah, you need a, did you not get it when you came in? Did you not tell them that you're going to, like, they come up with this fucking story, and I'm like, no. And so they're obviously taking the piss out of me, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, but I'm 19 and I don't know any better, you know what I mean? So I'm like, no, I didn't get that. So we had this old like Mercedes van that they had, this guy named Gaz had, that we would all drive in it, but it had an exhaust leak. So there was like a hole on the floorboard in the back.
Yeah.
And so we would cover it up with an amp. Right. So we'd put a Marshall cabinet with the back down on top of the hole. Right. And it would sit in the middle of the van. So they said, oh, fuck, we're going to have to smuggle you in. So, OK, well, we're almost to the border, Lars. You're going to need to hide yourself. I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm like, oh, great. So I'm like, OK, what do we, you know, got to do what I got to do. You know what I mean? So, you know, I want, you know, I mean, what am I going to say? No.
Yeah. It's your first time there too, probably, right?
Like. It is my first time there. That's why they're easy, you know, taking the piss out of me. So where the hole is on the floor, Brian Barnes, the bass player, goes, oh, let me help you, mate. I got a great idea. And I go, fine. He goes, here, help me pick this up. So we lift up the Marshall. He goes, you cover the hole. I remember I was wearing this sheepskin jacket. I'll never forget it because there was a spot on that sheepskin jacket right where I was covering the hole. And he goes, I'm going to put the Marshall on you. You hold on to it. So basically, and then I feel like these bags being thrown on my feet. You know what I mean? I'm holding this Marshall cabinet on top of me. I'm face up. I got my head kind of to the side and I'm just thinking, fuck, I, you know, fuck. I hope I don't get caught. I hope I don't get caught. That's what's going through my fucking head, right? Assholes. And obviously Gaz is like swerving, you know, you see the bumpies hitting it, you know what I mean? And so this goes on for about a half an hour, 45 minutes. I don't know, or at least it seems that much. And all of a sudden I hear Charlie like giggling. And I'm like, what the fuck, right? And I'm like, and then all of a sudden like everybody's kind of snickering and kind of whispering and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, maybe we're getting close to the border. No, they're just fucking laughing at the fucking stupid American that's got the fucking Marshall cabinet clogging the hole to the exhaust so the exhaust doesn't come into the fucking van and kill us all. Like, that's what I'm doing. And basically, I kind of figure it out and I get up and then I throw the amp off of me and I kind of sit up and everybody just starts pointing and laughing at me like, you fucking idiot. You know what I mean? Like, so.
Oh, well. I don't think that's the story I was bringing up because I think the story I remember hearing was that you were smuggled in a drum case when you were underage to a show or you had to sit in a drum to keep it from rolling.
Okay.
MDC. That's the story I was thinking.
No. That was for the Necros.
That was for the Necros.
The Necros. It was Ronnie. Oh, okay. Ronnie Tannehill's backyard party. Okay. So I'm 11 years old.
Yeah.
And it's like the Faction, the Necros. Living Abortions. Fuck. Who else was there?
What backyard party? Oh,
yeah. It's just some backyard party. It's Ronnie Tannehill's like 16th or 17th birthday. His parents were like just smoking and drinking with everybody. His kegs, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I go. There's some pictures. Murray Bowles actually. There's he was at the show apparently and took a bunch of these pictures. So there's like pictures of this 11-year-old Lars with my bleached jeans and my kind of long hair and my flannel shirt and my boots. And what ended up happening was the drum kit, because it was on concrete, it kept sliding and they tried to put cinder blocks and all these things. And throughout the whole show, you know, the drummer was having issues. So finally,
Like, I don't even remember. I was sitting on the side watching the band, and somebody yelled, and I want to say it was either Corey O'Brien, who was Gavin's younger brother, said, "Why don't you just stick fucking Lars in the fucking thing?" And everybody kind of looked at me and it was like, great idea. Let's stick the fucking, you know, 11-year-old in the fucking kick drum. And that's kind of what happened. They stuck me in the fucking kick drum. So it quit moving. And I had to sit there for the Faction. There's a picture of me sitting in it for the Faction. And there's a picture of me sitting in it for the Necros. And I had the best spot on the, you know, on the stage, obviously, but all I could hear was the fucking kick drum. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Not an audio ideal spot.
No, but I remember what's his name from Necros, the singer. God, what was
Barry Hensler.
Came up to me and he goes, "Hey, thanks, man. I really appreciate it." And he goes and gets me a t-shirt, and there was like this silkscreen t-shirt with this small ass print, but the t-shirt was like fucking, you know, like an extra large or something, and it looked like a dress on me. You know what I mean? And he's like, you know, but he was really cool. You know, he gave me a beer, and he's just like, "Hey, thanks a lot." You know, and but that's, you know, I was a dumb kid. I didn't know any better. Like, somebody asked me to sit in a drum kit now, I'd be like, fuck you. Yeah. You know what I mean? But yeah, no, that there's pictures out there. Yeah, I was like 11 years old. I mean, no wonder why I'm fucking deaf. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you paid your dues early. Holy jeez.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those ways, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So sure. At which point did you start playing music? Obviously, that was your first major stage experience, but
So I guess I always wanted to play the guitar. I think somebody gave me a bass when I was about 13, and it had two strings on it, and I never ever played it. And then my brother brought home, he got a guitar, and it was like this Stratocaster copy that he had put Budweiser labels all over because they kind of stick. And then he put like, so it was like this Budweiser labeled guitar. And I remember I used to sneak it from underneath his, he'd put it underneath his bed. And if he ever caught me, he'd beat the shit out. He said, "Don't touch my fucking guitar." And, but I, of course, you know, when you tell me not to do something, I do it. Right. So.
And your brothers, you have to.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's like a rite of passage to get your ass beat on a daily. And my brother was a very gnarly motherfucker. You know what I mean? So like getting beat up by him wasn't like getting beat up. It was like getting like fucking maimed. You know what I mean? He wouldn't stop. I remember one time he attacked me with a butter knife when I was in the shower, and he started making, you know, that psycho, he goes, you know, that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he was legit like crazy. Like if anybody ever fucked with me, or try to beat me up or whatever, he would go over to their house and destroy them and then come back and beat the shit out of me. Like, why did you make me go do that to him? You know what I mean? Like, you know, he was a great guy. I mean, you know, we hated each other for a long time, you know, but before he died, it was kind of amazing. It was like, you know, we sort of saw, you know, about a couple of weeks before we kind of started seeing eye to eye for the first time, which was kind of nice. But, you know, I kind of got off target.
No, no, absolutely. You're talking about stealing his guitar.
Gotcha. So that's the first time I would sit with every record I had. It didn't matter what kind of record it was. And I would just try to sound like that. Like, I make sure that this sounds good. What I'm playing sounds that. No one ever really showed me a bar chord. I think I saw somebody playing it on MTV or whatever, and I tried it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would go to live shows or whatever, and I would see the bands, how they do it. And Mike Ness, actually, when I was about 11 years old, taught me how to play Telling Them on the E string of his, he had it like this Cherry Sunburst Les Paul. I remember being at this house, and he was kind of the first one that gave me the guitar and said, "Here, play it." And he just showed me on the E string how to play Telling Them.
What an awesome story.
Yeah. Holy and, I mean, we were, you know, he was high on fucking speed and shit and doing all of his makeup and, you know, doing the whole skit for me from fucking Another State of Mind. It looks like someone crying, you know, yeah. I would totally remember it. But we were friends.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and that was the first time I picked up a guitar was through him. He let me play his guitar. And then I would steal my brother's a few years later, and I would just try to make sounds. And then Simon Woodstock, who became a pro skateboarder, he was from my neighborhood, and he had a brother who was in a band, and that was where I got my first guitar, because I bought my – I did Simon's paper route for it was like 2 months. And it was, and he wanted to sell me his, it was like this purple Les Paul Jr. that I used. And it's the, it's what turned out the cover of the Roots Radicals 7-inch is that guitar smashed. Okay. Cause the band Ransom bought me a new Epiphone in 93 for my birthday. And, cause the guitar was shit, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I smashed it. We played with Bad Religion at the, Palladium, and I smashed it during Hyena, because we always would close with Hyena. And I smashed it, and I still actually have the remnants of it in my garage. But that was the first guitar I ever owned, and I paid $150, although I was, it was kind of like I was an indentured servant, because I did, you know, somebody's paper route for 2 months, and that's how I got the guitar. I was about 16 when I got
it. Wow. You put in your work for that guitar, but also, what an iconic, like, you carried it through and still made it, even in death, ring on for eternity. That guitar. Also, yeah. What was Simon Woodstock's brother's band?
I don't know, but he had like an older brother, and I think he was like a stepbrother, like his mom had married a new guy.
Okay.
And it was his son from his first marriage. And it was like a rock band. And but the guitar had belonged to a guy in a band called the Purple People Eaters.
Oh, okay.
And there's some, and I've tried to do my research on them back in the day. I haven't really looked at it, but they were a legit band. I think they had like a minor hit, but the guitar was purple.
That's awesome.
But wow, that was,
I actually think I heard like that. Were they like a 60s or 70s band?
I think so. And his brother had some sort of connection. He either played in the later formation of that band. I mean, we're talking, this is 1980, so I might have been younger than 16. So this is like 1985, 86 when I got that guitar.
Wow. Well, do you remember also when Simon Woodstock fought Mike Muir?
I do recall that, but by then, you know, Simon had gone, we kind of gone our different ways. He's now like a Baptist minister now or something, the last time I heard.
Wow, I had no idea about that part. I just remember the Mike Muir fight. And I think it's on YouTube too, even now.
Doesn't he kick his ass though, right?
Yeah. That's what I remember kind of unfolding in.
Yeah, well, Simon had a lot of pent up aggression, and
he's ripped as shit.
Yeah, well, I threw down many, many times with Simon side to side, and I know what he was capable of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lars, I have kept you for a long time, and my God, we haven't even gotten to you joining the UK subs. This is the greatest episode ever.
Well, I mean, you know, tell me what you want to do. I'm free.
If you want, can you talk for like a few more minutes, and then we'll call it an episode?
Whatever you want to do. I mean, it's on you, bro. Like, If you want to talk all day, I can do that. Like I said, this is the first time in a long time I got nothing going on.
Well,
like,
then I'm going to have to keep gone. You. I'm going to have
yeah,
to keep
the kids are gone. The wife is gone. It's like the perfect day to catch me.
Well, my kids are downstairs chilling with my wife comfortably, and so I am ready to keep going.
Okay. Let's do it.
So I guess, like, so you start playing, and what do you remember, like, when you first started playing with a band or the first people you played with?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the first band that I really ever got into was this band called the Nowhere Men.
Okay.
And that was with Gordy, who later became the Unknown Bastard in The Bastards.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
I think I knew that, actually. Sorry.
Yeah. So he was the singer, and it was an oi band. And this is like 1988, 89. And we had Ken Head. We called him Ken Head because he was a skinhead, and his name was Ken. He played the drums. We had this guy named Brandon, who was this long-haired metal guy on guitar. Me on guitar, Pasta on the bass, and then Gordy sang. And we did like we actually did a demo. I don't even have a copy of it myself. I don't think I have to take a look, but it was just, you know, shouting oi, you know, I remember one of the songs was called Working Class. And it was like, working class, strength through oi, working class, not a politician's toy, working class, strength through oi, let's get together now. Like, that was the chorus, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was, you know, obviously very juvenile, but, you know, that was kind of the first thing. We did some shows with, like, we play with the Mentors, we play with Aggression, we play with JFA, Blast, Capital Punishment, you know.
Slow down. You just play with, like, an unbelievable list of bands that you said there. That's awesome. Holy shit.
But, I mean, you know, and
those
the Melvins.
Locals, I guess, right?
Yeah, when we played with the Melvins at one point. We actually played. That's how I got the gig in the UK Subs, because we played the Omni at this all-day punk fest, and the Subs played the Gilman. They played at a matinee. So after their show, they came over to the punk fest, and the headliners were the Melvins. And it was like the Melvins, JFA, Capital Punishment. They're from Fresno, if I remember correctly. And Blast. And we had played with Blast a few times because so I knew Clifford, and so that he would invite us to play. And so the UK sub, so Charlie and the guitar player, Carl, at the time, who had been in The Exploited, he was on that Horror Epics record, and they came down to the show. And ironically, at the time, the Nowhere Men were doing Organized Crime, which was a UK sub song, and he saw us playing it. And I went to the bar after the show, and I went to go order a beer or whatever with the drink ticket, and Charlie Harper's right there, and he's like, "Hey, great set tonight." And I looked over and I'm like, "Oh fuck, it's Charlie Harper." And I go, "Oh, cool. I heard you guys were playing over at Berkeley. How'd it go?" And he goes, I loved your version of Organized Crime. It was really good. You played the guitar perfectly, because whatever. And he was really, really nice. And so we started talking, and he goes, "Let me buy you a drink." So he bought me a beer. And we sat down and we started talking and, you know, making small talk and just talking about, you know, whatever, punk and, you know, what happened to this guy. And, you know, because I remember him, there's a picture of him on the back of the second Oi record. And I asked him about the photo and, you know, blah, 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 you know, just trying to, you know, just being, you know, whatever, friendly. And so he says to me, like about 15 minutes into the conversation, "Hey, you know, we're losing our guitar player after this tour, you know, would you be interested?" And I was like, yeah, but I thought, you know, I thought he was just like trying to be nice or something. "Hey, you're good enough to do this," or something. And I was like, "Yeah, I'm interested." And he goes, "Well, give me your number." And I was at my mom's house, still living there, because I was kind of going back from there, back and forth from Hayward, where I was living with this girl, to my mom's, you know, depending if we were fighting or not, right? Mm-hmm. So at that point, we were fighting, so I was staying down in Campbell still. So he said, "Well, I'm going to be in Oakland for like 3 or 4 days. I think it was a Friday when this gig was. And it was a Sunday. And he said, I'm going to be here till next weekend. Let's get together on Friday next week, and you come down, we'll talk, and because I'm going to be in Oakland." And I was like, yeah sure. So anyways, he gives me a number where he's staying. He called some girl over. They were staying at some house in Oakland. I get this phone number. Friday rolls around. I don't call him, because I just thought, you know, he was just being nice or whatever. Mm-hmm. Saturday morning at about 9 a.m I get a call. I'm sleeping on my mom's living room floor, and it's Charlie Harper saying, "Yes, I'm looking for Lars, blah, 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 blah. This is Charlie," and, you know, whatever. And so I pick up the phone. I'm like, "Hey, Charlie, it's Lars." And he goes, "Hey, what happened? I thought we were going to get together yesterday." I'm like, I go, "You know what, Charlie? I didn't think you were being that serious." He goes, "What do you mean? I'm deadly serious." He goes, "What are you doing today or tomorrow?" He says, and it would have been Sunday. And I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, can you come and meet me in Oakland?" And I said, "Yes, I can." So, I go, so, you know, I've had the Saturday, the Sunday, My mom was going to this place called the Nordic House, which is like where you get Danish food, right? Mm-hmm. And it just so happens to be on Telegraph where, well, it's not, it's no longer there. It's on San Pablo. It's on San Pablo, over in Oakland. And it's in like deep in the heart of the shitsville of Oakland at the time, right? And she was going to go up there and get some cheese and Danish salami, whatever. And she goes, you know what? I'm going up there on Sunday. I can drive you up there. And I'm like, great. So my mom drives me and she dumps me off at the Nordic House. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning. And Charlie says, you know, if you walk down the street and I see a Winnebago basically on the road, right? And I knock on the door and they're all there, except for Carl. Carl's not there. And basically, we sit down and we talk, and me and Charlie hang out. We went and saw that night. We got lost on the BART together. We were trying to get over to San Francisco. We ended up way out like in Walnut Creek or whatever. I said, Charlie, I think we got on the wrong train because we were talking so much. So we finally get over to San Francisco. We go to Haight Street and we went to this place called the I-Beam. And we went and saw Buck Naked in the Bare Bottom Boys. I don't know if you remember that no. person. Well, I think he ended up getting murdered at Dolores Park or something later sometime.
Wow.
But we end up hanging out, and I end up spending the night in the Winnebago. We have a few beers, you know, blah, blah, blah. He says, listen, my wife is from Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm going to be there for the next couple months. Can you send me a demo tape of your band so I can see blah, 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 and this and that? I said, sure. So we part ways. I make it back home. I get a tape of the Nowhere Men. I send it to him. And on my birthday, I get a letter back from Charlie. I remember I was high on fucking speed. I was so high. And because it was my birthday. So
yeah, it's your birthday.
Yeah. And I was high on speed and I was still drunk. My mom said, I came home at like 11 o'clock. I spent the night with this girl I was kind of seeing. I spent the night with her. I come home. I was actually with Gordy. I was with Gordy and his wife. Obviously this is, you know, fucking 25 plus years ago, but her parents were out of town. We threw a little party at the house for my birthday, the night before. So I come home, I'm on my birthday, I get this letter from Charlie basically saying, you're in the band, I can't believe you want to leave your band to join my band, you're great, but you're bubbles and that, this and that, we need to make plans, we have a show on October, this is August 30th, so he says, we have a show on October, blah, 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 with the X-Ray Specs, and this is when those first, these kind of first punk, big punk festivals where they're getting a lot of these older bands and putting them all together, so it was like the Lurkers, X-Ray Specs, Vibrators, UK Subs, Chelsea, you know.
What is this all like for you though? Like, cause this is your shit. Like this, like, you know, obviously Oi is more your stuff, but I mean, like, what's it like, even like the UK Sub thing happening to you as like a kid going through this?
Well, see, that's the crazy part, because I remember, you know, Sean having Another Kind of Blues, that the first UK Subs record. I don't know how many times I listened to that record. It's probably in the thousands. I mean, the UK Subs, when I, you know, started like, you know, spiking my hair and putting on leather jackets with studs. UK Subs always made my jacket. So here I am now about to join this band. I'm like thinking to myself, like, how the fuck does this happen? Here's the irony of it. During my conversation with Charlie, he goes, so you're from Campbell, right? I go, yeah. And he goes, yeah, I lived there for a year in 1974. And he goes, do you remember a bar called The Apple? And I'm like, oh my God, he did really live here in 1974. You know what I mean?
Wow. He said, yeah,
I was dating a girl, you know, because he was a hairstylist. Mm-hmm. That's what he did for a living, you know? And he was dating some girl from California. She lived in Campbell. He was dating her. He moved to Campbell. Little did I know that when I was 3 fucking years old or 2 years old, Charlie Harper, a guy I would later become in a band with, was going to the Apple Bar. Well, I could still take you there now.
It's still there, that bar?
I'm pretty sure it is. It's right where my mom lives now.
Wow. Well, that is a historic bar, to say the least. I had no idea he lived in America for a time.
Neither did I. But when he dropped that knowledge, that's when I knew, you know. But and Charlie's not, you know, he's not a liar either.
No.
He's not someone. So anyways, that's in my mind. But so I get, so this is what happens. I go, Mom, I got this opportunity. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to move to England. And she says, well, you know what? I can't help you. You know, you're going to have to, you know, get there yourself. And I said, okay, fine. So I let Charlie know I can't get there because I got to work. Now I have to go get a job and get enough money. My plan is I'm working at Togo's, which is a sandwich restaurant. And I go and get this job. And I figure, okay, if the plane ticket's about $400, I'm going to need about, you know, what, I don't know, $200. I don't know. I remember my aunt gave me a check for $25 for my birthday, right? And I haven't cashed it yet. So basically, I get this job at Togo's. You know, I tell everybody in the band, you know, hey, I'm going to go join the UK subs. You know, Gordy's always obviously very supportive of me, you know, always has been, always will be. You know, I go and I join the UK subs. I fly over there in November of that year. And,
he literally lost his love to the UK subs.
Yes, he literally did.
He literally did.
So, you know, I landed, I was shit hammered drunk. They barely let me into the country. I had like 5 suitcases with me because I didn't know any better. I pretty much packed up everything I ever owned, you know, because I, you know, except for my records, I left my records behind.
Yeah.
You know, I ended up just getting rid of so much shit because I had, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But, you know, I end up moving there. I have $400 in my, or $200 in my pocket. I, you know, I quit the job as soon as I got enough money for the plane ticket. I bought the plane ticket, you know. My girlfriend at the time takes her and this guy named Elliot, who was her roommate's boyfriend, dropped me off at San Francisco International. I flew to England, and next thing you know, I'm in a fucking one bedroom apartment in Brixton, and sleeping on the floor with 3 other people, you know. And that's the way we did it, you know. And the next, in a week later, or 2 days later, we're in the rehearsal room. You know, I've learned 45, 50 of their songs. And we're just going through the songs. Hey, can you do this one? Hey, can you do this? Yes, yes, yes. And we have maybe a 4-hour rehearsal, and I play my first show 2 nights later.
Wow. And that first show is that X-Ray Specs Lurkers Super Bill type thing.
No, I missed that one because I had to get that
plane ticket. Yeah.
Yes. So, of course. And that's pretty much how it happened. Little did I know that 3-4 months later, I'd be on a plane home because I was such a fucking wreck. You know, because when I joined that band, like, I was so far into my drinking and using that, like, the one of the most embarrassing times I've ever had on stage was at a UK sub show. And it was at the, we were main support for Discharge. Because Cal had rejoined the band. They put out this record called Massacre Divine. We were at the Nottingham Rock City. And I remember, or was it Nottingham? It was a rock city somewhere. It was a bigger venue. Mm-hmm. And I was so hammered that I went down to turn a knob on my distortion pedal. I fell off the stage.
Yeah.
I knocked my guitar out of tune. And there was a band called Blitzkrieg who was opening some of the shows.
The band that was on No Future?
Correct.
Oh, that band, yeah, I love that 7-inch.
Okay, so the guitar player gives me his guitar. Little do I know it's tuned a whole step down. I'm so drunk, I can't tell. So we're playing Born a Rocker, Die a Rocker, and I'm completely out of key. It was embarrassing for everybody else. Remember Charlie, there was these fucking crazy motherfucking skinhead security that had all these Rottweilers. For whatever reason, the Rottweilers hated everybody except for me. I literally slept with the dogs that night. It was so fucking cold. It was in the middle of December. It was like one of the coldest winters that they had in a long time. And I had like 6 Rottweilers And I'm in a fucking van with all these fucking crazy ass skinheads with face tattoos. You know what I mean? And the dogs are keeping me warm. They wouldn't even let me get my sleeping bag out of the fucking van. So I embarrassed them pretty much. So that's kind of how that whole thing ended. You know what I mean?
But you were super young to be going through that experience.
Well, like, that was the thing. I was 19, you know, and these guys had been well-traveled veterans. Charlie at the time, I think, was close to 50. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and then Pete Davies was in the band, who was the drummer on Another Kind of Blues. And I think the first 7-inch as well. Because their original guitar player was this black guy named, what was his fucking name? He's the guy that wrote CID.
Oh, that song is so sick.
Yeah, and I forget his fucking name. You know, so I was in that. So it was me, Brian Barnes, who was the closest in age to me, who was, I think, 27 or 28 at the time. And then there was Charlie and Pete, who were about the same age. So they had already seen that, been there and done that. They had done that, you know, 20 years prior to me joining the band. So they didn't really want, you know, some 19-year-old kid. Yeah, I could play the songs to a T, but, you know, I was also a handful. I mean, I got them banned from this town called Ironbridge. They could never go back there again because of my antics. You know, I it's the only time I've ever gotten a banned from a town, and it happened to be the UK subs. And it's funny because we did a photo session there in the morning before the local townspeople came and said, don't ever come back. And Charlie actually reminded me of it. I was with him when he had his apartment about 10 years ago, and he gave me the actual photo. He said, because me and Charlie had a big falling out after that, you know, because he had an idea about how he wanted me to be. And of course I was 19 and wasn't going to listen to anybody. I mean, my mom couldn't change me from the way I acted. Like, who the fuck is my punk rock idol telling me I need to be, look this way or act this way? Like, fuck you, you know, yeah. You know, and so I badmouthed them in this interview I did when I joined Rancid. And I was working at Tower Records right before we were about to make Let's Go. And I picked up this fanzine and it said interview with the UK subs. And for whatever reason, I opened it up to the page where they're talking to Charlie. And they asked the question, you know, Lars from Rancid, you know, talks some smack about you, you know, like, I can't even remember how it was even worded. You know, what do you say about that? And the way Charlie answered that question made me feel about, I don't know, less than 2 inches tall. And, it was really humbling, you know, cause I kind of badmouthed him, you know, because I was angry, you know, I said some things, you know, whatever, you know, I was dumb, but it was great because in 1995, you know, Rancid played at the Underworld in Camden and over in England. And I got to meet Charlie and we hugged it out. And ever since then, he's, you know, he's been like a grandfather to my kids, you know? So.
No, we got to open for him one time, and what, like, still this day, what an amazing kind of legend to still be that guy. And he's still cool. Yeah. He was awesome to us too.
Well, that's the way he is, though. I mean, he'll continue doing it, and he's like one of the most humble guys in the world. And he's got a great knowledge, you know, of everything, you know. And I just never, you know.
Well, he never left too. Like, you know, like, where are they now? It's correct. Not like really about the UK subs,
right? It's true. It's true.
My God, Lars, do I want to talk to you forever? But I should let you go.
Because, okay.
This has been awesome, and we aren't even at you joining Rancid, and I have as I told you in advance, sheets of questions to get to myself. But
okay,
I will. But thank you, man, for doing this. This has been an unbelievably fun conversation. I've had a blast.
Well, I had a great time too. This is probably the best interview I've ever done. So, if you ever want to continue where you left off, I'm happy to do that.
Oh my God! Well. Congratulations, everyone. You've just met your new Turn It A Punk co-host.